From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There was a time when you could always rely on cab drivers to know their way around the city. But now in American cities, lots of cab drivers are newly arrived immigrants. It can be pretty frustrating for a passenger, but what's the experience like for an immigrant cabbie? On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Soviet emigre Vladimir Lobus, author of the new memoir, Taxi from Hell, Confessions of a Russian Hack. Also today, we talk with one of the original members of the British punk band The Sex Pistols. Glenn Matlock was the bass player before Sid Vicious. Matlock recorded only one song with the Pistols, but he co-wrote their best-known songs. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new British comedy, Life is Sweet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Against a backdrop of continued fighting in Croatia, the European community began yet another attempt to find a solution to the Yugoslav crisis. From London, Michael Goldfarb reports.
Britain's Lord Carrington, chairman of the EC peace mission, flew back to the Balkan region for meetings with Croatian and Serbian leaders. Last week, after the 12th EC-brokered ceasefire had failed, Carrington had suspended the EC talks. The British diplomat explained he was resuming his peacekeeping efforts because, for the first time, both Croatia and Serbia have called for an international peacekeeping force to be sent to Yugoslavia. He told reporters, "I think it's worth going out there to see whether we can do something along those lines." He met first with Croatian President Franjo Tudjman in Graz, Austria, because of the difficulty in flying into Croatian territory. Then he flew to Belgrade, where he met with Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. He told both leaders that a peacekeeping force would be sent to Yugoslavia only if the fighting stops. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Former Cambodian ruler Prince Norodom Sihanouk is on his way home to Phnom Penh after 13 years of exile. Sihanouk left Beijing earlier today on a flight with Prime Minister Hun Sen, the head of the former Chinese-backed government. The prince will head a Supreme National Council composed of representatives of all four of the factions that fought in Cambodia's civil war. By a vote of 253 to 177, the House passed another family and medical leave bill, which is expected to be rejected by President Bush. The House failed to muster the two-thirds majority needed to override the president's threatened veto. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The legislation requires businesses with 50 or more employees to provide up to 12 weeks of unpaid job-protected leave to workers caring for a newborn or newly adopted child or a sick relative. Opponents of the bill argue that such a mandate will force employers to cut back on other benefits and that it will hurt small businesses. But supporters argue that because the bill includes all kinds of exemptions, it won't apply to 95% of the nation's employers. Majority Leader Richard Gephardt says the legislation tries to address the conflict experienced by a growing number of Americans.
The issue is, do we want to have a policy in our country that says that workers will not have to choose between a newborn baby and their job?
President Bush is expected to veto the bill. He says he will oppose any government-mandated family leave arrangement. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The blue-chip stocks closed higher today on Wall Street, despite reports of a bigger-than-expected gain in inflation at the wholesale level. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 3,065. Declines edged advances in active trading. This is NPR. President Bush called Republican leaders tonight to congratulate them on reaching agreement on a measure that will extend unemployment benefits for up to 20 weeks. The $5.2 billion measure is designed to help the estimated 3 million Americans who've used up the standard 26 weeks of insurance and are still out of work. The president killed two similar bills earlier this year, saying they were too expensive and would not be needed when the economy recovered from recession. Gun owners have turned more than 7,000 weapons over to the St. Louis police in the last month as part of the city's gun buyback program. Kathy Lohr reports from St. Louis.
Police are calling their gun buyback campaign a success here. Over 30 days, the department spent about $350,000 to buy guns of all kinds. during the first few days, police stations were filled with people turning in their guns. In return, police handed out vouchers for groceries and cash. Police estimate that by the end of the day, they will have collected about 7,500 guns. The idea came from a similar program in Philadelphia last summer, but the St. Louis campaign brought in more than seven times the number of weapons collected in Philadelphia. Several other cities have initiated plans for their own gun buybacks. But there's no way to judge whether the programs will have any impact on the crime rate. The murder rate in this city is up about 30% from last year. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in St. Louis.
Acting Attorney General William Barr said today that he's ordered an investigation into allegations that Justice Department officials conspired to force the Inslaw computer software company out of business. The longstanding allegations claim that Justice Department officials stole a computer software plan that Inslaw had written for U.S. attorneys' offices under a government contract. Inslaw's former owners claim that the company was then forced into bankruptcy to cover up the theft. Barr said he's ordered a special counsel to investigate. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
May 10th. Thank God for the rain, which has helped wash away the garbage and the trash off the sidewalks. I'm working long hours now, 6 days a week. Sometimes 7 days a week. It's a long hustle, but it keeps me real busy. I can take in $350 a week, sometimes even more when I do it off the meter.
Let's face it, when you hail a cab, you never know what you're in store for, and there's nothing like a scene from Taxi Driver to remind you of that. Let me tell you about one of my recent taxi nightmares. I was in a strange city, and I needed to take a taxi out into one of the neighborhoods. Well, I get in the cab, and it turns out the driver doesn't speak more than 5 words of English. So I write down the address for him, and he reassures me with a combination of body language and his 5 words that he knows how to get there. Turns out he was faking it. The only reason we're still not driving around lost is that I grabbed his map and directed him. Nowadays in big cities, lots of the cabbies don't speak much English and don't yet know their way around. So I was pretty interested when I found the new memoir, Taxi from Hell, written by a Russian emigre who started driving a cab in New York before he could speak much English, before he knew his way around, in fact, before he could even drive. Well, it was pretty interesting to read about this nightmare from his perspective, so we invited him to Fresh Air. His name is Vladimir Lobis. Most of his book was first published in the Soviet literary magazine Novy Mir. Lobis was a filmmaker in Russia. When he came to New York, he did a weekly program for Radio Liberty. After driving a cab for several years, he now owns a mini fleet of 8 cabs. First, I wanted some advice. Should I have tipped this cabbie who got lost, made me late, and drove me crazy?
Well, no, I would say not. You are not supposed to tip him. You were suffering, you got into trouble. You don't pay tips for your trouble. Well, I feel sorry for you, but this is a common thing. What can I say?
Now, you were on the other end of that. I mean, it was a bad experience for me, but you were often in the position in the early days when you started driving of being the taxi driver who didn't speak a word of English or spoke just a little bit of English, who didn't know your way around the city. So what was it like for you to have to take people to places that they didn't know how to get to and you didn't either?
Well, what can I say? It was a nightmare. It was awful. You feel awful. You understand that you are taking a person who is in a rush to nowhere. Well, what else I can say? Usually, finally, always, actually, I found the way the person needs. But I had a few similar cases like you just told me, and nobody feels good about it. This is hard. This is awful. You feel like you are annihilated driving a person just around and around and not know where exactly you have to take him or her. Well, it's drama. What can I say?
Sure is, right. Now, how would you find out how to get to a place When you didn't know how to get there?
Well, I usually asked drivers, I asked people at the gas stations. Sometimes they gave me proper directions, sometimes they gave me wrong directions. But in all these situations, the only thing I can say, I can compliment the public. People in the back seat were understandable. I was wasting their time, their money, and they still were understandable. And what can I say after all these years? Thank you very much for being so nice to me, to thousands of other cab drivers, immigrants. Thank you, Americans. That's all what I can say.
I'm sure everybody wasn't so nice.
Well, you know, I didn't have any exceptions. I never got a person who didn't understand me. People were not nice. My passengers were not nice when I got worse, when I started to behave, to be angry, upset. But if a person in the back seat sees that the cab driver just doing his best and he can't do it because he doesn't know anything, they're never angry. They're always understandable. They're always trying to help. And this is wonderful. That's what I can say about this.
You know, there really are a lot of Soviet emigre taxi drivers in New York. And in fact, it always seems to me that in Manhattan, most of the taxi drivers are people who've recently arrived from other countries. What is the popularity of that particular profession to people who are recently arrived to the United States? Can you help explain?
Yeah, sure. You see, 90%, I would say, or at least 80% of New York taxi drivers are immigrants, not only from Russia, from Poland, from Israel, from Haiti, from all over the world. Usually, well, I don't know, usually or in 50%, it's hard to count percentage here. A lot of them are representatives of intelligentsia, like lawyers, like engineers, writers. In my team, I'm an owner of a few cabs now. In my team, among 8 yellow cab drivers, I have a script writer from Hong Kong, an engineer from India, a lawyer from Cairo, a mathematician from Alexandria, Egypt. It's the half of them. Are highly educated.
We should say here that you were a cinematographer when you
were in the Soviet Union. Yeah, I used to be a cinematographer, a movie maker. Yeah, I was a script writer, a director. So it was the same fate. Life puts you behind the wheel of a yellow cab because these people from all over the world can't make a living in New York. Even I in New York, I was working for Radio Liberty Committee. I had 2 every week show, one in Russian language, one in Ukrainian language. I still was paid $190 per week, and I had a family to support. Plus to this, I ran into my dental problem, and I just tried to make a buck driving a cab, and it became my profession for good 8 years.
What were some of the worst mistakes you made in your cab early on?
Well, worst, you mean the most dangerous or the most funny?
Well, why don't you give us one funny and one dangerous?
All right. Well, one funny was when I picked up, the funniest was when I picked up in Greenwich Village a father of 2 little girls, and he asked me to drive him to Kennedy, and it was my first trip to Kennedy.
This is Kennedy Airport.
Kennedy Airport, yeah. And I was so excited that at last I got this $20 job. So I took cases, I took 2 girls, I forgot to take father and started to go.
You pulled off without him?
Yes. And what was horrible in this case, that when girls told me, our daddy isn't here, our daddy isn't here, and I turned around and I looked that he is not in a cab, and I realized that I don't remember where I picked him up. It's village, it's a maze, it's... And the girls told me the directions. One was 4 years old, another was probably 3 years old.
Oh, okay.
And they told me to turn right to Burger King and then to make a left, and then we saw Daddy. That was very funny, and that was horrible at the same time. And again, I must say a big compliment to public, to this wonderful man who didn't curse me out.
I think you're lucky you're alive, actually.
Yes. I just, when I saw him, I thought, my God, what this man came through when some suspicious-looking guy, not passing himself as a taxi driver and not knowing the way to the airport, took his kids and disappeared and left him on the street. And he didn't curse me out, as I said. He didn't take away the job. He just got into the cab and said something like, "You must be more careful." Well, I apologize like hell. What can I say? I was more scared probably than him.
What's something dangerous that happened to you?
Something dangerous. It was an awful, real awful story. It was on a Park Avenue. My cab had partition. And I was driving a woman with a small boy who didn't want to sit on mom's lap or on a seat. He wanted to stay, and he put his hands on a place where partition moves. Partition was open at the same time.
Is that like bulletproof shield between the passenger and the cab?
Yes. And then it happens that we started to argue with this woman. She thought that I was driving very carefully, since I understand that the boy is staying in a checker cab. And she said something like, "I specially purposely stop on a yellow light to make timer running and to squeeze an extra 10 cents. And I was very angry, and I, without turning my head, I closed the partition. And that was a horrible moment in my life, because after I did it and I heard the boy was crying, I thought that I hurt his fingers. Luckily, nothing happened. The boy was just scared, but it was an awful moment. And since then, I told myself, never argue in a car. Never argue. Doesn't matter how upset you are. You are insulted or not, doesn't matter what you feel, you never argue with a customer. If you can drive this customer, just pull over and say, "I can't drive you." But don't do such a thing, because I nearly crippled the child.
You know, I'd ask you if you were ever robbed while driving a cab, but I think what I ought to ask is, how many times were you robbed
while
driving a cab?
The second question is more proper. Every taxi driver in New York who drive a few years was robbed. I was robbed twice. One was easy experience. They took money from on a short pocket. I had some singles, and the guy took it. But the other time, the second time, robbery was quite awful. It happened in East New York. You want me to tell the story?
Yeah.
It happened in East New York. It was 3 p.m. Sunday afternoon. Everybody dressed like going to the church. Streets were sunny days. Streets were full of people. And it was traffic. And I just had a family which I brought from Kennedy. I dropped them, Kennedy Airport. I dropped them off, and then I just didn't know the shortest way back to the airport, so I stepped out of my car, which was blocked in the traffic, and I came to the driver in the next car and asked how to get to Kennedy. And it happened he didn't know, so I continued, and I stepped down to another car and asked, "Can you tell me how to go to Kennedy?" And the person started explaining me. And then suddenly I saw three youngsters, not running, but walking fast in direction to my cab. Your intuition immediately tells you everything. If you just get into trouble, if you don't believe, don't trust to what your intuition says. My intuition said me, that's it. So I stopped listening to the person. I didn't walk. I ran to my cab. I got into the cab. I closed the door, but I lost a split of a second to lock the door. And they opened two doors from two sides. They put me down on the seat. They, I don't know this English word, they put their hands on my throat. They were kids, beginners. They don't know what they are doing. They were looking for money. It lasted, like, a good 5 minutes. And they didn't find money. They just found singles, took the singles, and finally they ran away, leaving. But it all happened at 3 p.m. in a street where I was locked with cars behind me and after me. It were at least 200 people around. Nobody interfered. Nobody looked in my side. That was awful.
Aren't you afraid to get back into a cab again when something like that happens?
No. Well, you are afraid. You see, you are not afraid. You feel a few days, a few weeks. You feel that something happened, awful happened to you. But then it goes down and down. You feel less and less. Actually, I tried to work even after this happened, that day, but I couldn't work. I came home. But the next day, next morning, I was behind the wheel. It's no games. You have to work. You have to produce money. You have to pay awful bills. So you don't allow emotions to rule your life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Vladimir Lobos, and he's a Soviet emigre who drove a taxi for around 8 years, now owns around 8 taxis, and he's written a memoir about these experiences called Taxi from Hell, Confessions of a Russian Hack. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Vladimir Lobos, a Soviet emigre who drove a cab for many years in New York, now owns a small fleet of taxis and has written a memoir called Taxi from Hell. In New York, the most prized fare is the fare to Kennedy Airport. Why is that such a great fare to get?
Well, in New York, this is the only one way today to travel somewhere, to be paid 30 or 35 or even more dollars, and you have a chance to get a fare back. So if you will be very lucky, you can make like $60-$70 in 2 hours, which is a lot of money for a driver. And that's you can beat this job. This is the best job in New York.
Now, what does it take to get a fare to the airport?
Well, you see, if you're just driving honestly, picking up everybody, I would say you will get a Kennedy job once in 2 or 3 weeks. But some drivers hunt for these jobs. They make friendship with doormen. They pay the doormen, bribe them. And they get these jobs for, I believe today's rate is $3 a Kennedy job.
And that's $3 to the doorman?
Yes, yes. And that's how they get these jobs.
What does it take to actually make a profit when you're driving a cab for a company? How much money do you have to make in a day before you've made a profit for yourself?
Oh, I see. You see, I am using such words like bribing a doorman and comparing it with honest drivers, and I still can't blame New York taxi drivers for doing this, because New York taxi driver's situation is really awful. If he leases a cab, before he puts the first dollar in his pocket, he has to make $100. $80 cost lease of a 12-hour shift, and $20 cost gas. So to make his first buck, he has to make before $100, and this makes him to struggle for every buck. It's driving a cab in New York, it's everyday struggle. Struggle for life, for a dollar, for living, and this is very hard. So you can understand that the driver not always smile to his customer. He's not always nice. He's annihilated. He doesn't know what is this. He's facing that he will finish his 12-hour shift, fill up the tank, and bring home $22. He doesn't feel well. Or let's say, while he had lunch, a kind of punk broke his window and took his change from under the seat, and now he has to pay for the window $80, $90, $75, plus to the rent. And you can imagine how he feels.
You now own 8 taxis?
Well, I have 8 yellow cabs, 4 yellow cabs, and 4 so-called black cars, radio cars.
Now that you have a small fleet of taxis, you don't drive yourself anymore, right? I mean, drive a taxi.
Occasionally I drive when driver gets sick, driver asks me to replace him. They are all my friends because we are working like 3, 4, 5, 6 years together. So it's no relationship like employer and employee. So if he asks me, of course, I'm happy to help him. That's all.
You use a pseudonym. Vladimir Lobos is not your birth name. Did you need a pseudonym for political reasons?
No, I just I use my pen name, and I use it for years. It's the name of my Russian nanny, whom I loved very much, who was everything in my Russian life for me since I was a kid. And that's just nice. It's a very good feeling that I have my nanny's name, my Russian's nanny name, as a pen name. It's just warm, nice. I like it. That's all.
How was your cab ride on the way to the studio today?
Very good. I had a very good driver who spoke English. It was a black driver, very nice, polite. I just appreciate the service he gave me.
Did you give him a good tip?
Oh, yeah. You know,
how much do you tip in a taxi?
Well, you see, it's not specific. It's waiters and taxi drivers are the best tippers because we know how important it is for a driver, so we are happy to. Well, on a trip like $275, I gave him $4.
Okay, that's nice.
Well, I appreciate what he is doing. I understand how hard he is fighting for his buck, and I was not the best customer. I just traveled a few blocks, so I just told thank you and give him the money.
So I have to ask you, have you ever seen the movie Taxi Driver?
Yes, of course. I saw it. I love it. It's a wonderful movie. What can I say? Very exciting, very American, highly professional. I love Roberto De Niro. What can I say? It's a very good picture.
Well, Vladimir Lobos, I wish you the best, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vladimir Lobos is the author of Taxi from Hell, Confessions of a Russian Hack. It's published by Soho Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And here's more music from Bernard Herrmann's score for the film Taxi Driver.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Sex Pistols was the band most responsible for creating the image and attitude of punk rock in England. Glenn Matlock was the band's founding bassist. He's written a new memoir about life inside the Sex Pistols. He says he left the Pistols because the band was becoming too much like the Monkees. He was replaced by Sid Vicious. Coming up, we talk with Glenn Matlock about the early days of punk rock. 2 years ago, British film director Mike Leigh took a satirical look at Margaret Thatcher's England in his movie High Hopes. Now he's back with a new comedy about a working-class family. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Leigh's new film, Life is Sweet. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Congress has paved the way for another veto fight with the president, as the House this evening approved a family and medical leave already passed by the Senate. This measure guarantees many workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid job-protected leave, a measure that the president is expected to veto. The bill would require employees of 50 or more workers to guarantee their employees up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave due to illness, the birth or adoption of a child, or to care for an ill family member. The federal government has announced sweeping changes in the way new drugs will be reviewed and approved in this country. The goal of the program is to shorten the amount of time it takes a drug to move from the test tube to the drugstore. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Right now, it takes nearly 10 years for an experimental drug to move from the laboratory to the marketplace. The measures announced today seek to shorten that time to 7 years, and even less for drugs to combat dire illnesses like AIDS and cancer. The 11-point plan shifts some decision-making away from the FDA to university researchers and even private contractors. The FDA would also use more data from drug tests in other countries, even though that information has been shunned until now as inferior. Bush administration officials say the plan will save lives and money without compromising safety, but critics worry that the reforms could weaken the standards that have protected Americans from dangerous and worthless drugs for 30 years. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee has ended its hearings into President Bush's nomination of William Barr to be U.S. Attorney General. The chairman of that committee predicted that Barr will be confirmed by the full Senate. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Today, senators again questioned Barr about Justice's conduct of the BCCI investigation. Barr said there had been a minor turf battle among two sections of the department that had caused a delay in an indictment, but he said the spat had been resolved. Barr revealed that he had hired an independent counsel to advise him regarding the Inslaw scandal, in which the Justice Department has been accused of forcing a Washington-area firm into bankruptcy and then stealing computer software it designed. Barr said he had ordered a complete review of the case.
I'm interested, as this case goes on, to get to the bottom of it and bring it to some kind of resolution.
At the end of today's hearing, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden said he expects Barr will be confirmed by the Senate. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11 points to close at 3,065.30 on volume of some 183 million shares. Declining issues led advances by only a very slight margin in very active trading. This is NPR News. The government says that wholesale prices climbed a sharp 0.7% last month, for the largest advance in a year. Analysts believe this increase will forestall any further credit easing by the Federal Reserve. For most of this year, wholesale prices have been falling. However, last month, higher prices were widespread. Energy costs were up 1.7%, and food prices were up 0.4% after falling for four straight months. A German newspaper is reporting that a U.S. Embassy employee in Bonn spied for the East German secret police. Deidre Berger reports from Frankfurt.
German intelligence authorities are investigating the case together with the FBI, according to Die Welt newspaper. Since 1976, the unnamed U.S. Embassy employee reportedly passed on secret documents to Stasi, the East German secret police. The documents included detailed information about the NATO double-track missile deployment strategy, the location of U.S. Pershing II missiles in Germany, and the U.S. stance on the INF disarmament talks, according to the newspaper. Die Welt says the tip-off to intelligence agents came from former employees of the East German secret police, whose information has resulted in dozens of arrests within the German government on espionage charges since German unification. Justice officials estimate at least 400 to 500 former East German agents are still working in Bonn government offices. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
Exxon has paid Alaska and the federal government the first $125 million of a record $1 billion cash settlement over the nation's largest oil spill. The company is also expected to pay $90 million next month as the first installment of a $900 million settlement of a civil case in connection with the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When you think punk rock, you think the Sex Pistols. And when you think Sex Pistols, you think of Johnny Rotten and Sid Vicious. You may not even recognize the name Glenn Matlock. He was the original bass player with the British band before Sid Vicious. Matlock left the group before they recorded most of their songs, but he wrote the music for the songs they're best known for, including this one, God Save the Queen. The Sex Pistols created the image and attitude of British punk rock in the mid-70s. Matlock says that was part of the problem. The band became more about the punk image than music. He credits Malcolm McLaren with that problem. McLaren was the punk impresario who managed the band. In Matlock's new memoir, I Was a Teenage Sex Pistol, he writes about the early days of the band. He says he left in 1977 because the Pistols were becoming too much like the Monkees.
Well, the comparison there was that, as I understood the Monkees, they weren't a band as such. They weren't a band that evolved and got together to be a band by themselves. They were manipulated by their... it was made for a TV show, mainly, to cash in on the Beatles myth. And Malcolm tried to push it along the same kind of lines, and it wasn't like that. And to do that really denied the strength of what the band was all about, which was kids playing music for the kids and grabbing the ball by the horns for themselves, you know, and doing it with a lot of spunk and a lot of spirit.
What were your reasons for leaving the Sex Pistols besides the fact that it reminded you of the Monkees?
Well, that was the main reason, really. It became, how can I say this? It just became a caricature of itself, and it wasn't honest any longer. It became like a dishonest exercise somehow in my mind.
When you left the band, I think somebody made the statement that you were asked to leave because you liked the Beatles. Is that an apocryphal story, or did that really happen?
No, that's not true at all. I mean, I was, again, very annoyed with McLaren because what happened was I felt that I didn't want to continue with the band the way it was going, with the way Malcolm was steering it, and I said that to him. So he accepted that, and we shook hands on it. Again, this is all in the book. But a week later, he'd sent a telegram to the NME, which is like a music paper over here, saying what you just said, you know, and I felt very betrayed by Malcolm because I bore them no malice at all.
When you left the band and you were replaced on bass by Sid Vicious, what did you think of him as a performer in the Sex Pistols?
As a performer? As a performer, I thought he was great. As a bass player, I thought he was atrocious.
Did it matter that he didn't play bass?
What the band became, it didn't matter at all, no, because then it became that media exercise thing, but then it became not the rock band that it was supposed to be in the first place. So I don't know whether it mattered or not. In my book, it did matter, but ultimately, in what everybody else thinks, you know, perhaps it didn't. But I find that a bit sad, really. You know, that a circus act is more important than a really good rock and roll band.
The Sex Pistols got its start through Malcolm McLaren's shop in England. That's where you started to work when you were like 15 years old or something.
That's right, yeah.
And this is a shop that when you started working there specialized in 50s fashions and then ended up specializing in sex and fetishism. How did the band relate to the store? What was the connection?
Well, the main connection was that what was going on in London at the time was really that kind of glam rock thing, which was petering out by then. It was like a long-haired kind of hippie scene, and there weren't many places to go to identify with something that wasn't to do with all that. So Malcolm's shop was like the antithesis of that scene, but also it was a pretty funky kind of place, and it seemed pretty happening. So gradually, kids started hanging out there more and more, and it became like a hip place to be, and I thought, well, instead of just hanging out there, I'd rather get a job there and coin some money out of it, which I did. And that's how I met Steve and Paul. But it was because Malcolm had unwittingly provided some kind of almost youth club for kids in London who wanted to do something that was a bit more adventurous, you know, and just didn't want to go with the flow.
Did you start a band there independent of Malcolm McLaren?
Steve and Paul already had a band going. They was called Strand then, or the Swankers or something like that, and Paul's brother-in-law was the bass player, and he wasn't taking it that seriously, and Steve and Paul, and there was another guy called Wally, who was the guitarist at the time, were involved, and they wanted to take it real seriously. I overheard them actually mentioning to Malcolm that they were looking for a new bass player because Del, I think Paul's brother-in-law was called, wasn't working out. I overheard this. I said to Malcolm, well, look, I play bass, you know, mention it to him, which he did. And then I went off to rehearse with them, and we rehearsed for a good year before Malcolm even became involved at all.
It was Malcolm McLaren's idea, I think, to hire Johnny Rotten and bring him into the band.
I don't think it was, actually. Steve spotted him first, and he mentioned to Malcolm to keep a lookout for him because, again, John was one of the guys who used to come in the shop to hang out.
So how did the band change when Johnny Rotten, or Johnny Lydon, as he was then, joined?
Well, I think John basically encapsulated the spirit that we all had, and he managed to put what we were trying to do in terms of music and not being particularly creative lyrically. He kind of like hit the nail on the head, as it was, with his lyrics. And that was it, he was up and running.
Story behind the writing of Anarchy in the UK?
Well, yeah, basically it was that me and John had been on Steve's back because he was really seemed to be quite happy to take a back seat in the writing of the song, and we was having a go at him, and you know, he came up with a few ideas which weren't much cop, so he said, well, you're so clever then, you know, why don't you come up with something? I really didn't have much of an idea at all. I had this tiny little riff that I've been knocking around with at home. So I sort of tentatively played one chord, and he said, well, yeah, that's one chord. What comes next? And the first chord was a G, so the next one was an F. And I kind of worked it out there and then on the spot, and it just sounded really good. So that was how the song came about. But it was really through me being put on the spot more than anything else. And John had some lyrics, you know, and he sat down and wrote the lyrics to it there and then.
My guest is Glenn Matlock, the original bass player with the Sex Pistols. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Glenn Matlock is my guest. He's written a new memoir called I Was a Teenage Sex Pistol. What did you wear for gigs early on? Did the clothes come from Malcolm's shop?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I used to wear this little rubber suit with zips in the backside that you undid and your bum sort of hung out, which was quite nice if the gig was pretty hot, which they became. I mean, if you look at pictures of us these days of what we looked like then, it doesn't really seem that outrageous. It's short hair, drainpipe trousers. But at the time, everybody was into flares and loom pants and tie-dyed things and long hair. And we really sort of stuck out like sore thumbs, which was good, you know. But on the other hand, that kind of look did stem from... There's a thing in England, I doubt if you have in the States, called skinheads. And Stephen Paul used to be like the skinheads in West London, which is like very much a mod kind of connotation. It was the development of the mod thing. Working class kids work, you know, go out, like to look good. So there was quite a strong element of that in it, although we were never skinheads in the band as such. But that's why we were such an antithesis to the hippie thing, because skinheads hated hippies.
Well, now the word skinhead also has this racist implication to it. Did it then?
Yeah, well, it did then, yeah.
So you say in the book that you were once a bit of a skinhead yourself.
Yeah, a bit of one, but I was just sort of toying with the look more than anything else. There was no racist overtones to my side of things. And, yeah, some of the skinheads did, but, again, it was like a nucleus, a sort of a nutty hardcore of people. And with most trends, people kind of go for the look more than the politics of it. I mean, you're not particularly into racist or anti-racist politics at the age of 14 or 15. Or people in this country aren't really. Or even if they are, it's only because they don't understand things that well, you know.
The impression I have from your book is of all the things that you resented in terms of the image that Malcolm McLaren created for the Sex Pistols, what you resented most was the image that this was a band that couldn't really play.
Well, yeah, I do resent that, actually, and I find it particularly ironic that there's a new book been written by a friend of mine called John Savage, which has just come out, called England's Dreaming, and that's getting quite a lot of attention over it. It's been written in a very weighty style. And I've heard that Malcolm's called him up recently, you know, and he didn't realise the mistakes that he made. And then he's been doing, like, TV shows and things saying, you know, like, the Pistols were a great rock and roll band. They wrote some of the great just music since the 50s in terms of rock and roll. The thing is, it's taken him all this time to realise that. He didn't realise that at the time. He didn't realise what he had on his hands. And I feel very betrayed by Malcolm for him being such a schmuck, for not realising that. You know, if he'd been working with us instead of against us, I think you'd find that the Pistols would have been as big as the Stones, if not more so, and would never have sold out.
What do you think the future of the Sex Pistols would have been if it hadn't been for Malcolm McLaren? It would have been a very different band. Could be nobody would have heard you.
Well, sure. I don't think the Sex Pistols would have been the Sex Pistols without Malcolm McLaren. But I don't think Malcolm McLaren would have been Malcolm McLaren without the Sex Pistols. So it's like a very symbiotic relationship. I just think the things that Malcolm has said after the event aren't true. And I think they need to be put straight, which I've endeavoured to do so.
There's an incident that you talk about in the book where the band was on a TV show in England and ended up swearing live on British TV, which caused quite a stir in the press
The
public. Without repeating the words, because we wouldn't be able to broadcast them either, what happened?
What happened was we got invited to do this TV show. We just signed to EMI Records. We was about to embark on a nationwide tour, which was to be called the Anarchy Tour, with The Clash and The Damned and Johnny Thunders' Heartbreakers. And EMI Records had swung us this live TV show at 6 o'clock, I think it was called, it was known as the Bill Grundy Show. It was the Today programme, it was called. And anyway, we went on that, and as it happens, Bill Grundy didn't particularly want to interview us. And he used to like a drink and all that lot. And he'd had a big ruck with his producer upstairs, who told him that he had to interview us whether he liked it or not. Well, Bill Grundy obviously didn't like it, and he tried to vent his frustration on us. And he took it out on the wrong blokes, really. That was it. He encouraged us to swear, so we did. I mean, it was stupid. And then everybody was outraged. So there you go.
Well, what effect did that incident on TV have on the image of the band, and how did you use that?
It just put us fairly and squarely in the public eye.
So it was helpful?
Yeah, it was very helpful. I mean, we never moaned about it at all. We thought it was funny. It was stupid, really, you know.
You say your memory of the Anarchy Tour was of boredom. What was boring about it? Was your first national tour?
Most of the time we was held up in hotel rooms trying to find out whether we would be allowed to play at the local gig or not. So, you know, we didn't really know what was going on.
A lot of
so,
people...
So out of, I think there was supposed to be 26 gigs, we played 3.
What happened to the other 23?
Well, they got cancelled.
Because of the reputation of the band?
Because of the reputation of the band. And it was a sort of a big thing, you know, that they wanted us to play in front of the mayor of the town so he could sort of be like the official censor of the show, and if he thought it was all right, we could go on. But, we, you know, we wouldn't stand for that, so we refused to play. You know, it was either accept us as we were or don't get us at all. So they didn't get us at all in a lot of places.
So that was frustrating to you because you really wanted to play.
Well, really wanted to play, yeah. I mean, that's why I wanted to be in a band, you know. But on the other hand, we wasn't going to back down. I think it was ultimately more important not to back down.
You were named after Glenn Miller. The Glenn in Glenn Matlock was from Glenn Miller, which I think is pretty funny, considering the music you went on to play.
Yeah, the guy who took one flight too many, right? Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I suppose it is funny. Me mum and dad liked dance bands. That was a big thing in the late 40s, 50s, and Glenn Miller was their era. So here I am, Glenn Matlock.
So what did your parents think of the Sex Pistols?
Not a lot. They don't talk about it.
They still don't talk about it?
They still don't talk about it.
That's a period of your life you still don't talk about with them?
Yeah, I kind of mention it sometimes. And they said, Glenn, we really must read your book and all that. I said, look, I don't want to give it to you. And if I do give it to you, you know, like, you've got to accept it at face value. So I gave it to him, and next time I went round, it was like a stony silence. And my mum goes, this bit about the Irish people in there boiling their cabbage in the same water as the bacon. I never said that. And she did, you know, she always said it. So that was the only thing she picked up on. She was a bit worried about the Rileys downstairs. So mums, eh?
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Sorry, thank you very much.
Glenn Matlock was the original bass player with the Sex Pistols. His new memoir is called I Was a Teenage Sex Pistol. It's published in the States by Faber & Faber. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. The Food and Drug Administration has speeded up consideration of drugs again in response to the AIDS epidemic. There was a desegregation case from Mississippi argued in the Supreme Court. The plaintiffs charge that the state has a separate and unequal state college system. We're going to take a look at U.S.-China trade and profile Prince Norodom Sihanouk, who is back in Cambodia. And, Terry, it's that time of year again, the time when All Things Considered once again considers the question of cranberry sauce.
Well, okay, that and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In England, nearly everyone has seen director Mike Leigh's films, at least on TV. But here in America, we've only had the opportunity to see two: Bleak Moments, his first feature back in 1972, and High Hopes, his 1988 comedy of Thatcherism, which wound up on the 10 best lists of many critics, including ours, Stephen Schiff. And Stephen's already decided if Leigh's new film, Life is Sweet, belongs on the top 10 of 1991.
Definitely. Life is Sweet isn't as ambitious as High Hopes, or quite as perfectly made, but it's a brilliant comedy in its own right. An astonishing mixture of realism, grotesquerie, and bonkers slapstick that still manages to seem utterly believable. This time, Leigh's subject is a loving British family raising an unlovable daughter. Her name is Nicola, and she's half of a pair of twins, the other being quiet, sensible Natalie, who works as a plumber. Nicola doesn't do much of anything except make life miserable for her sister and her sweet working-class parents, ranting at them in her screechy voice, refusing to spend time with them, and yet refusing to go away. It's hard to imagine an American movie on the same subject that wouldn't spend the next 90 minutes soberly exploring what went wrong with this young hellion. ferreting out the traumatic incident or the primal scene or the point where parental love was withheld. But Lee realizes that life isn't a dramatic structure, that a sweet family can have a monstrous child and never know why, and that, moreover, many families can learn to live with it, even accommodate it as a part of the texture of their lives. Of course, watching a family accommodate a problem instead of yelling and screaming about it may sound lethally undramatic. But in Lee's hands, a kind of alchemy occurs. Every scene is full of surprises and new, tantalizing information. You can hear a little how it all works in a scene like this one, in which Nicola and her sister Natalie discuss men and a whole lot of other things.
All men are bastards.
What?
They're all potential rapists.
It's a bit sweeping.
All men have got the ability to rape.
Well, they don't all do it, do they?
If they've got the ability, they've got the desire.
That's paranoid rubbish.
What do you know about paranoia?
Well, not half as much as you do, I'll give you that.
You'll find out when you get to America.
I'm only going on a holiday.
So?
Or you think I'm going to get yanked off the plane at John F. Kennedy Airport and be raped and pillaged, dear?
You've got to be on your guard.
Do you hear what I just said?
What?
Yanked. Get it?
What?
Yanked. America.
Racist.
In that simplest of scenes, you can see the way Lee's particular brand of heightened reality operates. The comedy and the drama pour out of these characters in buckets, and all of it feels true, because Lee and his actors understand the characters with an almost unprecedented thoroughness. That's because Lee arrives at a finished product by the most unusual of methods. He begins without knowing anything, except whom he wants in his cast and what the general subject matter ought to be. Then he sends his actors out searching for people whom they can turn into characters. They do interviews, build imaginary biographies, and act out scenes that their budding personae might have gone through at various stages of their lives. All that takes 3 months. And at the end of it, Lee finally knows just 2 more things, what his premise is and what his locations are. Next, he takes his actors out on those locations, and for several more weeks, they improvise, until finally Lee has the material for a screenplay. With a methodology like that, he'll never attract big money or big stars. For one thing, his preparation takes too long, and for another, he never has a script to show anyone. But the actors he does hire, including his wife, the superb Alison Steadman, are absolutely wonderful, and the performances they give make your jaw drop. Life is Sweet can seem at times bewildering and crazy, and at other times its intimacy can give you the willies, but there's nothing else like it out there anywhere. And there won't be, until Mike Lee gets back to work again.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Salad, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
In Louisiana, David Duke, a former leader of the Ku Klux Klan, is running for governor against former Governor Edwin Edwards, who's been accused of racketeering, gambling, and womanizing. On the next Fresh Air, we examine the election campaign and ask what it has to tell us about race and politics in America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.